KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If the level of investment goes down, you will lose these improvements.
Cuts to weather research and climate modeling programs could affect the ability to forecast severe weather like tornadoes and hurricanes.
It's Friday, April 25th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, a big reversal by the Trump administration.
The Department of Health and Human Services says it will no longer cut funding for a landmark women's health study.
I mean, I'm totally relieved that we're not shutting down in 5 months.
Later, a look at the supernatural horror film Sinners and its director, Ryan Coogler.
This movie has taken in so far around $71 million already, which is really great for an R-rated horror movie, especially one with a predominantly black cast.
Also, you can't walk around in New York without seeing a bodega.
And when there's a bodega, there are bodega cats.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump is calling for Ukraine and Russia to meet on ending the war. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump says they're close to reaching a deal.
President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, traveled to Moscow to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in an effort to broker an end to the war in Ukraine. After the meeting, Trump took to social media, where he announced that most of the major points had been agreed to. He wrote, quote, they're very close to a deal, and the two sides should now meet at very high levels to finish it off. Trump went on to say that it was time to stop the bloodshed and that the U.S. will be wherever it's needed to help facilitate the end of this, quote, cruel and senseless war. The Trump administration has suggested that Ukraine would be expected to give up large portions of land, including the Crimean Peninsula, which Russia annexed in 2014, an idea that Ukraine has so far rejected. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
In a major reversal, the federal government says it's restoring the legal status of more than 1,000 international students whose visas it had moved to cancel in recent weeks. That's according to a lawyer representing plaintiffs in one of the cases. Multiple judges have already issued temporary orders directing the government to restore the students' records in a federal database that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, uses to monitor student visa holders while they're in the U.S. A government lawyer says DHS will develop a new process for terminating international student visas. After 3 days, officials at the Vatican say the public viewing of the late Pope Francis is over. Francis died Monday at the age of 88. NPR's Jason DeRose reports from Rome on the pontiff's upcoming funeral.
Pope Francis Requiem Mass begins Saturday morning in St. Peter's Square. World leaders, including President Donald Trump, are scheduled to attend, as is former U.S. President Joe Biden, who's a practicing Catholic. Francis' coffin will then be taken to the Basilica of St. Mary Major, where he'll be buried. Among those participating in the burial is former Los Angeles Archbishop Cardinal Roger Mahoney, who's been barred from public ministry in Los Angeles due to his role in the clergy sex abuse cover-up. Saturday begins a 9-day period of official mourning leading up to the conclave, at which cardinals will elect the next head of the Roman Catholic Church. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
While the Trump administration has backed off some of its global tariffs, the American public still appears nervous, at least based on the latest read on consumer sentiment from the University of Michigan. Poll taken this month shows consumer sentiment dropping 8% from March to its fourth lowest level on records, the date back to 1952. Survey's director says consumer sentiment fell across a wide swath of income levels. Stocks closed higher to end the week. The Dow was up 20 points. The Nasdaq gained 216 points. You're listening to NPR. Disgraced former U.S. Representative George Santos has been sentenced to more than 7 years in prison for crimes that got him kicked out of Congress. Santos asked the judge for mercy, then sobbed as his 87-month sentence was delivered. The New York Republican pleaded guilty last summer to federal wire fraud and aggravated identity theft. Santos admitted to deceiving donors and stealing the identities of nearly a dozen people to fund his congressional campaign. Santos is due to report to prison in July. Moose are on the move in Sweden. The mammals have begun their annual migration across the northern part of the country, and millions have tuned in to watch the slow TV. NPR's Ian Archie has more.
Each spring, hundreds of moose journey from their winter hangout spot to their summer one, which is in the mountains near the Sweden-Norway border. They're looking for new food sources as well as a nice place to raise their calves. Since 2019, Swedish public broadcaster SVT has live-streamed the trip. More than 9 million people watched around the world last year, and viewership is expected to be even higher this year. That's according to an executive producer of the live stream. The program is an indication of how popular the slow TV genre has become. Slow TV includes live, unedited, and hours or even months-long coverage of some routine event, usually with a theme or journey in mind. Ayanna Archie, NPR News.
Punk rock legend Billy Idol, whose sneering visage was an 80s MTV music industry mainstay, is out with his first new record in 11 years. English singer says the new album, entitled Dream Into It, includes duets with artists including Joan Jett, Avril Lavigne, and The Kills' Alison Mosshart. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California. The Trump administration is moving so fast that by Friday it can be hard to remember what happened on Monday. So before we plunge into the weekend, let's just take 4 minutes to make sense of the week, once again dominated by the trade war, stock market swings, and the war in Ukraine. It all appears to be taking a toll on President Trump's political standing. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, that's right. Give us 4 minutes, we'll give you the world or something like that.
Okay, the world. Let's begin with the war in Ukraine. This week, Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Vice President Vance both said the U.S. might walk away from talks if they can't get a deal done soon. What's going on?
Yeah, Trump's been frustrated by his inability to bring a swift end to the war in Ukraine. And that's, you know, not what he expected or said he could do when he was running for president.
If I'm president, I will have that war settled in one day, 24 hours. I would get a settlement in 24 hours.
If I were president, and I say this, I will end that war in one day. It'll take 24 hours.
One day.
You got that. 24 hours. That was Trump on GBN News out of the UK and on town halls on Fox News and CNN earlier in the campaign. After actually dealing with this, though, as president for a couple months, a decidedly different tone when asked about his promise to settle the war in 24 hours.
Well, I was being a little bit sarcastic when I said that. What I really mean is I'd like to get it settled.
That was Trump on Sinclair Broadcasting last month. And just yesterday, after being asked whether the U.S. would pull funding from Ukraine if no deal is reached soon, he was back to a familiar time frame.
Let's see what happens. I think we're going to make a deal. And if we make a deal, that'll be wonderful. We won't have to worry about your question. You can ask that question in 2 weeks.
It seems like with Ukraine, as with so many other negotiations, it's proved harder than he thought it would be.
Yes, and most experts knew that would be the case. The bigger issue here, though, is how the president has changed the American foreign policy position away from standing up for democracy abroad and towards strongmen like Putin, or at least drawing an equivalency, not, quote, taking sides when U.S. allies are standing with Ukraine.
Well, in another part of the world, the other big story this week was the trade war with China, where Trump seemed to be taking a softer tone. Why the shift?
Yeah, the administration definitely seems to be trying to take the temperature down. Here's what Trump had to say.
I'm not going to say, oh, I'm going to play hardball with China. I'm going to play hardball with you, President Xi. No, no. We're going to be very nice. They're going to be very nice.
So everyone's going to be very nice, but Trump still says that there's going to be 145% tariffs on China that are going to stay in effect, but he'd like to see a fair deal made. He said talks are active with the Chinese, but whether that's even happening at all is a sticking point. Beijing says there are no talks at this point and that they are not backing down. Trump, meanwhile, said in an interview with Time magazine that President Xi had called him, but asked about it today, Trump declined to say when or if that actually happened.
Trump's also taking a softer tone with Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, which is a big shift from a week ago.
Yeah, Trump said that he has no intention of firing Powell. That came after saying last week that he's not happy with him, that he wants him out. And earlier this week called him a major loser on social media before doing his about face. So Trump clearly responding to the markets. Wall Street liked the softer tone, but something tells me it's not the end of this here, because Trump wants Powell to turn the dials down on interest rates to help him politically, because frankly, it's not going that great for him politically right now when it comes to public opinion.
Tell us more about that. What do the polls show?
Yeah, all of them are pointing to in a downward direction for Trump. In particular, his economic numbers have plunged into the 30s, and his numbers on foreign policy, even immigration, are down too. Not great news as the president approaches 100 days in office next week, but is potentially even worse for Republican members of Congress who have to run for re-election next year. Trump, of course, on the other hand, is constitutionally barred from running for a third term, though that hasn't stopped the Trump store from going up this week with Trump 2028 hats and T-shirts.
The World in 4 minutes from Domenico Montanaro. Thank you.
You got it.
Weather research and climate modeling are among the programs seeing big cuts by the Trump administration. At NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, hundreds of employees who work in offices and research centers have been fired. The administration also wants to cut hundreds of millions of dollars in funding for everything from weather satellites to climate research. NPR's Greg Allen reports former NOAA scientists warn the cuts may affect the agency's ability to forecast severe weather like tornadoes and hurricanes.
It's been a tumultuous time for hundreds of NOAA probationary employees, people who were recently hired or promoted. They were fired in February, then following a court order, were rehired and put on administrative leave. But after a Supreme Court ruling this month, the employees were fired again, including Andy Hazelton, a physical scientist with NOAA in Miami. He said he loved his job.
Yeah, well, just because I'm passionate about the work we do, you know, I've been a part of the success that's happened over the last 5 to 10 years in terms of protecting lives and property.
Until his job was terminated, Hazelton worked to help understand, track, and forecast hurricanes at NOAA's Environmental Modeling Center. The model he worked on, the Hurricane Analysis and Forecast System, also known as HAFS, has led to a marked improvement in forecasting. The deputy director of the National Hurricane Center, Jamie Rome, says HAFS, along with other models developed by NOAA scientists, allow them to do something impossible just a decade ago: forecast when a storm may rapidly intensify into a major hurricane, saving lives by giving residents more time to evacuate.
There have been several cases where our forecasters have aggressively forecast and communicated that rapid intensification was not just a possibility, but in all likelihood was going to occur.
This hurricane, Milton, has been rapidly intensifying already, going through a rapid intensification cycle.
Last year, the HAFS model Hazelton worked on helped meteorologists accurately forecast the rapid intensification of both hurricanes Milton and Helene. He's one of some 20 people fired from the Environmental Modeling Center and the Geophysical Fluid Dynamic Lab, another important NOAA research facility. All the cuts, he worries, may slow or end the progress made in developing weather and climate models.
Certainly, if the level of investment goes down, you will lose these improvements. It's hard to speculate for sure, but we already were kind of in a situation where we needed more investment.
While most of the job terminations were ordered in the name of downsizing and government efficiency, other funding cuts and recommendations appear to be ideological. President Trump's Commerce Secretary recently announced the withdrawal of $4 million in grants to Princeton University for climate research, saying that it promoted, quote, exaggerated and implausible climate threats. Also this month, a NOAA budget proposal outlined massive cuts that would eliminate most of the agency's scientific research programs. Congress would have to approve the draft budget, but it includes a plan to cancel contracts for the next generation of geostationary satellites. Mary Glacken, a former NOAA undersecretary, says those satellites, which stay in place and track weather in a region in real time, are crucial tools in understanding and forecasting the weather.
If we didn't have that, we'd have to wait until the polar satellites cross a couple of times a day. You'll miss them developing storms, for example, in the Midwest, tornadoes, or how hurricanes are evolving.
Glacken's concerned not just about the cuts in research, but also about those affecting the more than 120 National Weather Service field offices across the nation. At a recent congressional forum, she warned, lives are at risk, people will die from this.
If your alarms don't go off, you know, in the Midwest where they have sirens, so if the siren doesn't go off, then you're going to be caught unawares. That's what I'm worried about.
Because of staffing shortages, field offices are now conducting fewer weather balloon launches that monitor the atmosphere. NOAA also abruptly canceled the contract of a company that translated weather alerts into Spanish and other languages, but after an outcry, now says it will be reinstated. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Every part of New York has bodegas, shops with everything from beer to batteries to lottery tickets. And in many of them, you'll find a cat to eliminate rodents and attract customers. Cat lover Jeff London decided to explore their popularity.
Whenever I pass my local bodega and see Lola, their fluffy black and white cat, through the window, I go inside to say hello.
Hey, Lola. Psst, psst, psst.
Sometimes I take a picture of her and post it online. Like me, Dan Ramada started posting pictures of bodega cats on social media, but it exploded into a business.
The intention was not to start a bodega cat Instagram. The intention was I was going to snap photos of bodega cats myself with just my iPhone. And then people started sending me photos of their bodega cats, and then it just kind of spiraled from there.
In addition to his social media accounts, Ramada has an Etsy page selling apparel and stickers. He leads cat tours in the city and is working on a coffee table book. We met at a bodega in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and went on kind of a bodega crawl, meeting cats across the neighborhood.
Hey, Prince. Hi, bud. How's it going?
Prince was a beautiful gray kitten. A few steps away, in another store, we met a chunky tortie named Tiger. Store clerk Kareem Chinara.
So many customers like the Tiger. She's a friendly for everybody.
Well, maybe not the rodents.
Between 30 and 40% of bodegas in New York City probably have cats. They're not always in the front of the house. Sometimes they're kept in the back. You know, they're working animals.
And some are celebrities. Comedian Michelle Adana has become something of a TikTok superstar, talking with bodega owners, customers, and kitties on ShopCat's show.
I heard there was a grumpy bodega cat in here. Let's go check it out.
Where are you?
One staple of each episode is where Michelle Adana tries to determine if the bodega cat is a hunter or a gatherer and pulls out a cat toy on a string.
Let's see if Simba is a hunter or a gatherer.
I love bodega cats. I've never had a pet, and my mom has always said no.
As has the New York City Department of Health. Dan Ramada says bodega cats are actually illegal in New York.
Sometimes the health inspectors will look the other way, sometimes they won't. But it's just one of those things where, like, as a bodega owner, you have to face a fine. I mean, you get a choice. Like, you get a fine for having a cat or get a bigger fine for having a rodent problem.
So Ramada has set up a petition, and full disclosure, I've signed it, to designate bodega cats as working animals to help change the law. He's also raising money to help pay for their veterinary care. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in Brooklyn.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In a dramatic reversal, the Trump administration has backtracked on a decision that had stunned medical researchers. The Department of Health and Human Services now says the government will restore funding that officials were planning to cut from a landmark study of women's health. Joining us to talk about this switch is NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Hey, Rob.
Hey there, Ari.
So you reported Wednesday that the Trump administration was slashing funding for this big study, the Women's Health Initiative. Now the decision is being reversed. What happened?
Yeah, it's been quite a roller coaster. Researchers around the country were devastated when they found out that the funding for the Women's Health Initiative data's collection centers would be cut in September. The project's been studying tens of thousands of middle-aged and older women for more than 30 years, producing a steady stream of groundbreaking discoveries about, you know, hormones, diet, exercise, cancer, heart disease. And terminating funding would have forced scientists to stop gathering information about more than 40,000 women who are now in their 80s and older. That would slam the door shut on hopes of gaining new insights into what makes women become frail and get sick as they age and how to protect their vitality. But then, late yesterday, the Health and Human Services Department issued a statement that basically said, never mind. I talked about this today with Marcia Stefanik at Stanford University. She runs one of the study's four regional centers.
I'm delighted. I mean, I'm totally relieved. I'm very happy as a scientist. I'm very happy as a woman. I'm happy for every woman I know will be able to figure out, you know, how do you manage your health so that you can live healthy and not just longer.
Rob, do you have any idea what went on behind the scenes, why this happened?
Well, the funding was initially cut because the administration is demanding that the National Institutes of Health and other federal health agencies cut more than a third of their spending on research contracts like this. But the HHS statement said that NIH had, quote, exceeded its internal targets for contract reductions, unquote. And so officials are now, quote, working to fully restore funding to these essential research efforts, unquote. So, yeah, it's been real whiplash.
So what happens now?
Well, that's a big question. The researchers have gotten very little information directly from the federal government about this. Nothing in writing, just initially a verbal notification that the funding was being cut. And then yesterday, they only heard about the reversal from news organizations. So they aren't sure exactly what's happening next. Will the initiative get, say, only 2 years of additional funding to essentially just allow the researchers to start shutting it down? Or will it get another 5-year extension to continue following these women, to take full advantage of the initiative's enormous repository of samples and data? That's all up in the air.
And just to take a step back and perhaps state the obvious, this is not normal, this kind of back and forth, right?
No, it isn't. But it has been happening a lot these days as the Trump administration has been slashing fundings across federal health agencies. There's just been a lot of chaos and confusion. Scientists and regulators getting fired and then sometimes rehired, put on an administrative leave, only to be then told, oh, wait, keep working a little longer. And there's been very little communication about why decisions are being made and how.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein, thank you.
Sure thing, Ari.
Sinners is a supernatural horror film set in 1930s Mississippi. It's about blues music and vampires.
There are legends of people with the gift of making music so true it can conjure spirits from the past and the future. This gift can bring fame and fortune.
Will somebody take me in your eyes?
But it also can pierce the veil between life and death.
It's also a box office hit, which has spurred a parallel conversation about Hollywood and director Ryan Coogler. Aisha Harris hosts NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, and she's here to tell us about the larger story around Sinners. Hi, Aisha.
Hey, great to be here.
Okay, Aisha, I have not seen Sinners yet, so I'm excited to talk with you about this. Can you just give us all a taste of what this movie's about?
The gist of it is it's 1932. Michael B. Jordan is playing these enterprising twin brothers, Smoke and Stack, and they return to their hometown of Clarksdale, Mississippi after being away in Chicago for a few years. They buy a sawmill, they set it up as a juke joint for the black people in their community to just, like, you know, let off steam and relax. And then the juke joint attracts, as you've already mentioned, some vampires. And then it gets kind of crazy.
Okay, I'm definitely going to have to check this one out. This is a cinematic partnership, though. You wrote for NPR's website that director Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan, they're really symbiotic. What is it that makes the two of them work so well?
Since Coogler's debut, Fruitvale Station, in 2013, Michael B. Jordan has been involved in every one of Coogler's projects. And so together they've made Creed, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. And while they were doing this, Coogler turned Jordan into a movie star. And in turn, Jordan helped Coogler create these stories that really show different sides of Black masculinity. Now, I think that, like, we should also note that, of course, Coogler has a lot of people he's worked with consistently over various projects, production design, music, and costuming. But it's really because Michael B. Jordan is the star of these films, this is the one we sort of latch on to the most. And it's been a really, really interesting partnership to watch them both grow creatively and artistically.
Sinners has raked in over $71 million in North American movie theaters since it opened last weekend. Can you just help me put that into some perspective?
Yeah, I mean, this is huge because you have an R-rated horror movie with a predominantly black cast. And then on top of that, this is a completely original story. It's not based on any previous franchises or intellectual property. And usually when we're talking about, you know, these big box office successes, we're talking about, you know, the franchises. We're talking about Avengers, Star Wars, like Marvel movies. And this movie has really benefited from the goodwill everyone has towards Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan, but also just really, really strong word of mouth. We're seeing this past week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, it's raking in around $7 million, $8 million on each of those individual days. And so people are seeing this and they're telling other people to see it. And it's just, it bodes very well that we are seeing something so original get so much success at the box office.
I know there's been a lot of conversation this week about Ryan Coogler's special deal with the studio Warner Brothers. Help us understand what makes that so unique.
There are multiple components to that deal that are just really, really sweet. But the biggest thing is that he gets the ownership rights reverted back to him after 25 years. There is a very short list of precedents when it comes to directors being able to achieve that. Quentin Tarantino is the most recent example with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But given that Ryan Coogler is a black director and he's only 38 years old, it's just really, really astonishing that he was able to capitalize off of all of the money, the billions of dollars he's made from his previous hits, and convince Warner to give him this. And it has industry people shaking in their boots and wringing their hands. But I think anyone looking at this and knowing what Coogler has been able to do, it makes sense. And it's really, really just great to see someone like him get to take advantage of all the work he's done.
That's Aisha Harris, host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
At one point, as a Jesuit priest in Argentina, Pope Francis was exiled for several years to a remote solitary post. It was a time that would transform him and a period Francis never spoke too much about.
And that's when I thought, oh, wow, that there must be something really here that is still emotionally resonant for him.
On the day of his funeral, we hear about a pivotal moment in Francis's life. On All Things Considered, from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump signed an executive order aimed at making deep sea mining easier.
The U.S. is going to stake claim to a part of international waters that is supposed to be for the benefit of all humankind and say, no, this part is ours.
Plus, we learn who the main character of the week is.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. A county judge in Wisconsin has been arrested on charges of obstructing federal agents during an immigration arrest operation last week. FBI Director Pam Bondi issued a stark warning in response to the arrest of Judge Hannah Dugan.
No one is above the law in this country. And if you are destroying evidence, if you are obstructing justice, when you have victims sitting in a courtroom of domestic violence and you're escorting a criminal defendant out a back door, it will not be tolerated, and it is a crime in the United States of America.
Dugan is accused of helping a Mexican national avoid arrest by federal immigration officials at the Milwaukee County Courthouse last week. A coalition of 19 states has filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration for threatening to withhold funds from K-12 schools that continue diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Laura Fitzgerald from Cap Radio reports three federal judges have already temporarily blocked the anti-DEI directive.
The lawsuit is in response to a Department of Education order from early April. It directs K-12 schools to comply with civil rights laws and stop ongoing DEI programs to receive federal funds. California Attorney General Rob Bonta is co-leading the lawsuit and says loss of federal funds would be catastrophic for many students.
With this order, the Department of Education is unapologetically abandoning its mission to ensure equal access to education. With this order, the president has yet again broken the law.
A Department of Education statement earlier this month says, quote, federal financial assistance is a privilege, not a right, and that DEI programs are discriminatory. For NPR News, I'm Laura Fitzgerald in Sacramento.
This is NPR News in Washington. The U.S. is seeing its most significant outbreak of measles in decades, with nearly 900 cases nationwide. Texas leads the outbreak with almost 650 confirmed cases. The numbers are on track to be the highest annual total since the disease was declared eliminated in the U.S. in 2000. A federal judge in New York has sentenced former U.S. Representative George Santos to more than 7 years in prison for wire fraud and identity theft. Desiree DiOrio of member station WSHU reports Santos deceived voters and donors during his 2022 campaign for Congress.
The less-than-one-term congressman represented parts of Queens and Long Island before his historic expulsion in 2023. U.S. Attorney John Durham says Santos has been ordered to pay over $500,000 in restitution and penalties.
And he's going to be punished for his staggering fraud, the abuses he put on our electoral process, for mocking our democratic institutions, and most importantly, for betraying and defrauding his supporters, his voters, his donors, federal agencies, state agencies.
Santos is expected to report to federal prison this summer. For NPR News, I'm Desiree DiOrio on Long Island.
Stocks closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow was up 20 points, the Nasdaq up 216. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Donald Trump signed an executive order yesterday saying that the U.S. should get into the business of deep-sea mining. The move puts America at odds with almost every other country, since most have agreed to hold off until industry rules can be established. Mining the remote ocean floor has also never been done at scale, and many are concerned it could damage an ecosystem we don't know a lot about. Daniel Ackerman covers science and climate, and he's been following the story and joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Dan, just start by telling us exactly what this executive order does.
Yeah, well, the order is meant to jumpstart the deep sea mining industry. You know, for decades, companies have been eyeing offshore deposits of minerals like nickel and cobalt. And there are a lot of these metals in the deep ocean. They could be used in energy technology like electric car batteries. And the U.S. Geological Survey calls these minerals critical to national defense and the economy. Now, at the same time, the Trump administration is concerned about China's dominance of global mineral supplies. That's a concern shared by many lawmakers, including Democrats in Congress. So this executive order is in part a way to go around China here and give the U.S. more control of these minerals. The order directs the U.S. government to fast-track permitting for companies that want to be the first to go out there and mine the deep sea and bring that material to the U.S. for processing and manufacturing. But all of this remains really controversial.
Explain why.
Well, marine scientists are worried that mining could damage deep ocean ecosystems that they're really just starting to understand. You know, researchers think the vast majority of animal species in the deep sea have yet to be discovered. And in part because of that, more than 30 countries have called for a moratorium on seabed mining, at least until strong regulations are in place. And for years, there have been international talks about whether to allow this industry and what the rules should be. But this executive order directs U.S. agencies to basically ignore those negotiations and act on their own. And the key point is this order covers not just U.S. waters, but international waters, too. I spoke with Cheryl Murdoch about this. She's a deep sea ecologist at Arizona State University.
This is just going to say, you know, the U.S. is going to stake claim to a part of international waters that is supposed to be for the benefit of all humankind and say, no, this part is ours and we're going to do what we like with it.
And, you know, one place that mining companies are really focused on is in the Pacific Ocean between Hawaii and Mexico, in an area that does fall under international waters. So a lot of countries are saying no single nation should be setting the rules here. Dozens like France, China, India, and Chile have all condemned the idea that the U.S. might go it alone.
Okay, Dan, so we've got this executive order. Tell us what might happen next.
Well, no one is going to go out and mine the seabed tomorrow. This is still a new industry. Mining firms still have to go through an application process. But some are really eager to push forward. They say international talks have been too slow, and the Trump administration seems to want to move fast. And the government is even considering buying up some of these seabed minerals and stockpiling them. And one thing I'm keeping an eye on is whether the Trump administration might lease out its own federal waters for mining. At least one company wants to do that in the waters near American Samoa.
That's reporter Daniel Ackerman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It seems like every week there is a new main character, someone or something the internet is obsessed with. And on any given week, it's a toss-up whether I know who it is or not. Luckily, I have seen our producer Mia Venkat's average daily screen time, and it is alarming. So I know that the internet's main character is inevitably on her radar, whoever or whatever it may be. Mia, thank you so much for putting your phone down, stopping the scrolling, and taking a moment to come into the studio.
Oh my God!
Too harsh? Okay, so who's this week's main character?
Okay, all right. This week's main character is actually two main characters. Mm. It's the Twinnies.
Oh, do you mean the Australians who talk at the same time?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I admit I scrolled past their video. I might have watched it once. Why are they the internet's main character?
So it's Bridget and Paula Powers, and they went viral this week because they were interviewed by 7 News Australia mm-hmm. since they witnessed a carjacking.
I feel like we need to paint a picture. They're like women of a certain age, blonde, yeah. may or may not be natural blondes.
They're in their 40s. They mm-hmm. have this like very curly hair. They also wear identical outfits all the time.
All the time.
And they were also wearing identical outfits in this news interview that they did. And I'll say, like, there's nothing funny about the actual content of the interview. They're talking about a carjacking, but people just couldn't get enough of what they sounded like.
Right.
And he goes, I'll shoot you. She goes, hey, I'm here to help. And mum distracting him to make him look the other way. And he looked the other way. And mum ran into the bush behind the fence.
Right. Okay. So, like, I feel bad laughing because right. it's a very serious subject. But also, I watched that interview like 12 times. I couldn't tell you a single detail from this carjacking because it's so distracting just watching this.
It's giving The Shining. What did the internet do with this viral interview?
Yeah, so obviously people are obsessed with the fact that these twins talk in sync. A bunch of creators recreated videos kind of like cloning themselves as the twins and like talking. This creator, Madison Humphrey, did one. The caption was, those twins trying to convince everyone that they have to speak at the same time.
And we were calling for help for our mom. And we were scared.
A lot of the comments and a lot of people are like, I don't know if I really believe that they right. talk in unison. Uh-huh. And like you can tell in some of the videos, one person will basically say an entire sentence and then the other twin will just kind of like land it.
All I was thinking about when we were running, I hope he doesn't fire. Yeah, mm-hmm. we were so blessed.
Who actually are these two women besides twins who talk at the same time and dress alike?
Right. So they actually run a like wildlife sanctuary in Australia. It's called the Twinnies Pelican and Seabird Rescue. This is like their life's mission. They're very passionate about it. Hmm. And this isn't even their first brush with fame. They've been interviewed before about the fact that they are twins that speak in unison.
I can imagine them being on the Australian version of like Wendy Williams.
Well, they were on Good Morning Britain with like Piers Morgan 8 years ago. And on that show, they got asked if they prepare their answers ahead of time.
We don't know how it happens. Like some people go do you rehearse a conversation? But we said, like, no, how can you rehearse a conversation? It's a bit stupid.
I personally love whimsy and I want to believe that they always talk at the same time. And it's not pre-planned.
Okay, Mia.
Yes.
We're not twins. We're not even siblings. We're not even in the same room right now. But do you think you and I could do this?
I think we could. What if we just try the goodbyes? The typical NPR goodbye.
Okay.
But I'm going to kind of take the lead on what you would say. And let's see if you can guess what I'll say.
Yeah, sure.
So.
Mia Venkat.
That was perfect.
Best interview.
Of my life. Thanks for joining us. Ari.
Oh, it's my turn. You are the greatest interviewer in the world.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. And inevitably, we have to go out on music by NSYNC.
I was going to say Birds of a Feather.
Because you were born in the 90s.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The roadways around the Ambassador Bridge connecting Detroit to Canada are notoriously confusing. Just ask any Detroiter. There's a ton of traffic, lots of construction, all making for a difficult drive. And as NPR's Jasmine Garst reports, making a wrong turn onto the U.S. side of the bridge has landed hundreds of immigrants in detention in the past few months.
The tips about the Ambassador Bridge started coming in months ago. That's Sarai describing a drive to Costco on a Saturday morning back in March. NPR's dropping her last name because she's an immigrant without legal status. The mother was with her two kids, aged 1 and 5, both U.S. citizens. So she's driving, and the GPS, she says, routed her onto the bridge. They were detained by CBP.
She says she was taken into a windowless office space near the bridge. It was cold. She was held there for nearly 6 days. When her one-year-old got sick and feverish, she was told there was no medicine. Why aren't you letting me talk to a lawyer? She says she asked officers. It felt like a kidnapping.
A wrong turn should not lead to a disappearance and an erosion of someone's due process.
That's Michigan Democratic Representative Rashida Tlaib. Sarai's interview aired on NPR last month. Her story led to an inquiry by Tlaib. On a visit to the site, the congresswoman says Customs and Border Protection officials specifically told her 213 people have been detained there just this year.
Those are the numbers we were given during our site visit. And he said, well, I just want you to know also, Congresswoman, that 90% of them were actually here in the United States. They just made a wrong turn.
At a press conference on Thursday in Detroit, the representative said she saw a small space without adequate food or accommodations for children.
I saw firsthand those conditions, and we're talking about a room with two basic cots. So this is an office space that is not equipped for detention or long-term stays, especially of families.
NPR knows of three U.S. citizen children who were held there. When reached for comment, a spokesperson for CBP disputed that there were 213 people detained since January. He said in a statement, the number is closer to 50. When asked, the spokesman refused to give his name. As the Trump administration ramps up its efforts to keep its promise of a historic mass deportation campaign, there's been reports of increasingly overcrowded detention centers. At Thursday's press conference, Miriam Ackerman, a senior staff attorney with the ACLU of Michigan, says this should not be dismissed as an issue that only affects immigrants without legal status.
Democracies don't deny people access to attorneys. It is naive to think that if we tolerate such incommunicado detention and disappearances for non-citizens, the government won't start doing the same thing to citizens.
She says what's been happening on the bridge should concern everyone. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump has recently invoked an 18th century law, the Alien Enemies Act, to justify rapid deportations. There's now a legal battle over whether they can continue. But where did this law come from, and why is it still on the books? Those are perfect questions for Rund Abdelfattah and Ramtin Arablouei, co-hosts of NPR's Throughline.
The Alien Enemies Act was drafted in 1798, more than a decade after the end of the Revolutionary War. The country was deeply polarized.
What was happening in 1798 was that there was lots of naval confrontation between the U.S. and France.
This is Daniel Tischner, a professor of political science at the University of Oregon.
There was a sense that we were, you know, facing an impending war with France.
And the Federalist Party, led by President John Adams and with a majority in Congress, was especially concerned.
So Federalists in Washington were particularly unnerved by all of this. They felt that we needed to ready the country for a possible war with France, and we're in no mood to put up with any kind of disloyal speech. So that's where the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 came out.
The Alien and Sedition Acts were made up of four laws. The most famous and controversial one was the Sedition Act. It made it illegal to, quote, print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, and malicious writings about the U.S. government. But another one of the four Sedition Acts slid more under the radar.
The Alien Enemies Act.
Whenever there is a declared war between the United States and any foreign nation or government,
the act has a few requirements. First of all, it's clearly not supposed to be used in peacetime. It says there has to be a declared war between the United States and a foreign nation or government. Second part, it can only be used against citizens of the foreign country or government that's at war with the U.S. And finally, those people have to be 14 years or older, and they can't be U.S. citizens.
The president is authorized in any such event, by his proclamation thereof, or any.
If all those criteria are met, the president is allowed to apprehend and deport non-citizens.
So the declared war seems
pretty cut and dry.
Black or white. Yeah.
That part's easy.
Yeah, but the active invasion part seems like it could be open to interpretation.
Correct. So the key part of that is the notion that a foreign nation is in the active attempt or engaged in a clear invasion of U.S. territory. And this part kind of dovetails with Article 2 of the Constitution, which says that presidents have the power to repel a foreign invasion. So even if you don't have at that point you might not have a declared war, but to keep us safe, you need that kind of decisive, independent action from somebody in government.
Given the context, the French and the British naval, wars that are happening, who are they thinking of when they're coming up with these, restrictions?
So they're particularly worried about the French, but also at the time, the Federalist Party was particularly hot and bothered about French and Irish immigrants who they worried were disloyal. They knew they were voting in larger numbers or kind of leaning towards Jefferson and the Democratic Republicans.
The Democratic Republicans were the opposition party led by Thomas Jefferson.
And so that was the group that they had in mind. But I'll just add really quickly, John Adams never invoked it because in his interpretation, there was never a declared war with France. Moreover, he did not see an active invasion taking place, so he never used it.
What was the kind of immediate response from the public and also other politicians?
The Alien Sedition Acts were incredibly unpopular, and a lot of it was about, protecting the Bill of Rights and not having that easily violated by, a tyrannical regime. And so that's how the Republicans and Jefferson framed it, as this is, a fundamental threat to the basic liberties of people in this country.
So since this was like a big issue, why after 1800 was this not like completely done away with and repealed?
I think because it wasn't really used. So the Sedition Act was used. It was deeply unpopular, lots of attention, lots of squabbling in newspaper columns and speeches on the floor of Congress about the Sedition Act, about whether it was just or not. Because Adams never invoked the Alien Enemies Act, it really didn't get a lot of attention. And so my hunch is that it was kind of swept under the rug in some ways.
Three future presidents would invoke the Alien Enemies Act. First against British citizens in the War of 1812. Then against Germans during World War I. Finally, in World War II, it paved the way for Japanese Americans to be forcibly removed to relocation centers.
That is what led to the internment of both Japanese American citizens and Japanese non-citizens. The Alien Enemies Act, in some senses, was kind of, you know, the first step in this regard.
That was the last time the law was used, until now.
That was Throughline's Ramtin Arablouei and Rund Abdel-Fattah talking with Daniel Tischner about the origins of the Alien Enemies Act. For the full story, listen to Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
An eastern box turtle could fit in your palm. The yellow speckled reptiles were once plentiful along the East Coast, and some people took them in as pets. That was the fate of a turtle named Rockalina back in 1977. For nearly 50 years, she lived in a New York home, eating cat food and occasionally lettuce.
Is she in good shape?
I'm going to be honest with you, no.
Chris Leone runs a reptile rehab center in New Jersey called Garden State Tortoise. He met Rockalina in February and started posting videos of her online.
Her beak is a mess, and you can see what has happened to her nails here. They are completely upturned.
Her once bright yellow skin was discolored, and dead skin covered her eyes so she couldn't see.
We thought we were going to lose her. I mean, right away, it was like, I don't know about this one.
At the rehab center, they pampered Rockalina and gave her a warm bath.
Within 45 to 50 minutes of her being in warm water, her eyes opened. And you could tell that she was just like, where am I? What's going on?
They gave her an antibiotic, fed her soft foods, and trimmed her nails and beak.
Every single step of the way that we did something, she immediately responded to it.
All right. Here she is, guys, little Rockalina.
Finally, this month, the turtle ventured outside for the first time in decades.
Oh my gosh. Look at her walking on that back foot, too. She was like, what is this? This soft grass and perking up and staring up into the sky and cocking her head, blinking her eyes.
And then Rockalina's instincts kicked in and she munched on an earthworm.
She's snapping at it. She's snapping at it.
Which Leone says is a promising sign.
It's just one of those moments where you're like, man, we really actually have a happy ending here.
But things aren't over for Rockalina just yet. Some eastern box turtles, they live more than 100 years, so she could still have decades to go. Leone plans to build her a pen outside, and he says he'll keep posting about her life to document the comeback of this scrappy little reptile.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And
hello, Liz. What's this noise I hear, huh?
I don't know, unless it's that suit of yours. Say, them stripes are so big it makes you look like you was behind the bars doing time. What are you in for, Jerry?
Well, I'm in for anything that you're in, Betsy. Hello, who are you in mourning for?
Mourning?
You're, I see.